Hello, and welcome to the TAA teleconference, Writing, Procrastination, and Resistance, How to Identify Your Funk and Move Through It, presented by Carrie Ann Rockmore. Carrie Ann is an author and speaker in the field of faculty development and leadership. She spent the early years of her professional career climbing the academic ladder while writing about interracial families. She is the author of Beyond Black, Biracial Identity in America, Raising Biracial Children, and over 24 articles and book chapters on multiracial youth. Carrie Ann's research has been featured in numerous media outlets such as the New York Times and ABC's 2020. After Carrie Ann became a tenured professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago, her focus shifted towards improving conditions for pre-tenure faculty by creating supportive communities for professional development, writing productivity, and work-life balance. Her award-winning work with the underrepresented faculty led to the publication of her most recent book, The Black Academic's Guide to Winning Tenure Without Losing Your Soul. Carrie Ann now provides workshops for new faculty at colleges across the U.S., facilitates a popular online discussion forum for underrepresented faculty, and works with a select group of new faculty each semester in her faculty success program. I now turn the teleconference over to Carrie Ann.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be with you today, and it's great to be providing this workshop for TAA. And, you know, to be honest, this is a workshop that is near and dear to my heart, writing procrastination and resistance. And I think it's incredibly important to talk about procrastination and to talk about resistance because, you know, so many of us experience it, but we don't talk about it with each other, or when we do talk about it, we talk about it in ways that are incredibly oversimplified, that I think are mostly wrong, and in many ways just aren't helpful. And I think our inability to really understand how our resistance works and to really work with our own avoidance, our own procrastination, our own resistance, you know, it causes many of us to be very stressed out and unfortunately unproductive. So what I want to do today is really talk in three parts. I want to talk about the fact that, you know, we kind of know what works. In other words, we know the kinds of behaviors and activities around writing that make people productive. I'm going to describe what those are quickly. I don't think probably that will be news to many of you. But to me, the second part is much more important. If we know what works, then why don't we do it, right? If we know that there are strategies that lead to productivity, then why is it that so few of us actually engage in them? And then really the meat of this workshop today, even though we have a short time together, is to really give you a framework to be able to understand and identify your particular and unique writing funk, and so that you have a variety of strategies that you can try to move through that particular funk. And I want to be totally clear where I'm coming from and what my standpoint is. I'm not talking about this subject as someone who has, you know, completely overcome all resistance, never procrastinates, and is completely devoid of writing funks. It couldn't be any further from the truth. Even though I've written three books and a number of articles, I really struggle with writing, and I have tremendous amount of resistance. I struggled with writing this morning before this workshop, so I'm not saying, and I'm not really presenting these ideas today in a spirit of this is really easy, you just try a few things and you'll be all fixed, or that everyone is going to have all their writing problems solved by the end of this workshop. But I really, my goals are to really encourage you to rethink what your resistance is, to think about it in a fundamentally different way. And I want you to leave with a framework where you can really identify your specific writing funk and that you have a sense of having a lot of different concrete strategies to move through that funk. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask that you hold your questions to the end of the workshop. I'm probably going to talk for about 45 to 50 minutes. I'll leave a few minutes at the end for questions, and then I will hang around for another 20 to 30 minutes on the line to go ahead and take people's questions. But what I really want is for you, I have a lot of content. I know you're sitting in front of a large pile of slides if you're looking at the slides. But I really want to give you a new framework for understanding resistance and a lot of different ways that you can try to address your particular funk, okay? So let's start off by talking about what works, because I think we do know what works, right? Most of us are academic writers. We may be at the dissertation phase. We may be on the tenure track. But we all live in a publish and perish universe, right? So our publications in the academic marketplace, that's really what determines your value, your market value if you're trying to find a job, or your institutional value if you're trying to get tenure or promotion. And ultimately, the fact that our primary value is often resting on our ability to publish, our ability to write regularly and publish our ideas, that's great. That's what most of us got PhDs for. But the problem is that we're human beings, and as human beings, we tend to prioritize our activities and our behavior based on what we're going to be held accountable for. And unfortunately, if you're a new faculty member, you already probably know that the most important activity in terms of your promotion, in terms of your mobility, in terms of your professional reputation, that being writing, that activity that is so important has the least accountability, right? So your teaching has a huge amount of accountability because you stand in front of a classroom several times during the week, and none of us want to stand in front of people and not know what we're doing. I think service also has its own accountability because we have to go to meetings, we have to produce reports and documents, there are deadlines. Both of those things have built-in accountability structures. We're not going to show up to class empty-handed. We're not going to show up to a meeting without having done our portion of the work. But unfortunately, that thing that matters most in how successful we're going to be as academics, it has the least amount of accountability. And I want to make this tension very explicit because it's a really important tension, and it's important to recognize that it's a structural tension. I'm hearing a little background noise, so if somebody could mute themselves, that would be great. The point here is that it's a structural tension. It's not about a personality failing of yours. It's not because you have difficulty managing your time, but it's the way that your job is set up. And so when we have writing issues, we have to remember that we're sort of pushing against the way that our jobs are set up to hold us accountable. But we do know what works, right? So social scientists who study faculty members and productivity have documented in really clear ways the kinds of behaviors that faculty who are productive in their writing and who are successful have. And, you know, I had these listed on the slides if you're following along, but they're very specific. Productive new faculty really manage and reduce their teaching and service time so that they're spending no more than 2 hours of prep per hour of class time. They write every single day, Monday through Friday, for at least 30 minutes and maxing out at about 60 minutes. They're regularly communicating with their colleagues, not about departmental gossip, but about their research and teaching. They're very clear about keeping records about how work time is spent, and they create accountability structures for writing that rival those that are built in for their teaching and for their service. And, you know, you may hear or you may be reading this list of behaviors, and you may be saying, well, oh, I do all those things. That sounds just like me. But it's probably the case that you're reading those things and you think, oh, gosh, I don't do any of those things. And if you don't do any of those things, that's perfectly fine. What that makes you is the typical faculty member, right? So these behaviors that I'm describing, researchers have found that they exist between among about 5 to 9% of new faculty. And what that means is that over 90% of faculty aren't doing any of these things. And instead, they're spending the vast majority of their time on teaching. They're spending enormous amounts of time on service. And the typical new faculty member's approach to writing is that they hope it's going to get done at the end of the day. They hope it's going to get done on the weekend. They hope it's going to get done maybe on the break, maybe summer vacation. But there's really much more hope than there is writing going on. So it seems to me that the core question is, if we know what works, if we know that people who are productive write every day, and they write every day in small increments of time, then why don't we do it? I'm sure I'm not the first person you've heard say you should write every day. And yet, it is so incredibly difficult for people, myself included, to sit down every day, get their butt in a chair, turn on a computer, or pick up a pen, and actually write for 30 to 60 minutes. So why is it so hard? I mean, why is it so incredibly difficult if that's sort of the key to being productive? And I think there's really no simple answer. I think there are external challenges and there are internal challenges. So, you know, the external challenges, you know, the primary one, as I've always described, is that your job is set up to hold you accountable for teaching and for service. It's not necessarily set up to have built an accountability around writing. But I think people also find that it's difficult to sit down and write because many academic departments, you know, I'm trying to be as pleasant as possible, but many academic departments include people who are socially and interpersonally challenged. And what ends up happening is that particularly new faculty tend to spend a lot of time maneuvering around conflict, spend a lot of time and energy on relationships with other people who may be difficult to deal with, and that's energy that isn't set up, that can't be used to write. So if you find yourself angry, frustrated, disrespected, annoyed, having difficult interactions with colleagues, sometimes that can take some time and energy away from the actual writing. Some people's environments are those in which their substantive research just isn't supported. So the department hired them because they wanted to have somebody who does X, but they're the only person who does X. And because of that, they can feel a sense of isolation, a sense of a lack of support, none of which are really conducive to and supportive to getting writing done. And finally, you know, one thing I hear people talk about all the time is that their department has a really clear and extraordinarily high expectation of productivity, but there just isn't anything in place to support that productivity. So they're constantly being told, you need to publish, you need to get external grants, you need to do this, you need to do that. But that's sort of the end of the communication. There's no real communication about how to manage your time to get that done or how to actually create community around that. But, you know, these external challenges are things that you don't necessarily control, and I'm not going to focus a lot on them today because they're things that not only you don't have a lot of control over but are unlikely to change between now and the time that you come up for tenure or by the time you come up, you finish your PhD and go on the job market. So, instead, what I want to talk about are really these internal challenges. So you may, in fact, be in an environment that doesn't support and hold you accountable for writing, But that's just the external. So what happens inside? What's going on internally that keeps people from writing every day, 30 to 60 minutes? And for me, you know, the primary internal challenge is resistance. And, you know, what do I mean by resistance? Well, resistance is when you really want to do something, it's really important to you, but you just can't seem to do it. And, you know, resistance doesn't just happen around writing. It happens around a lot of different things. You know, for example, I have a lot of resistance around exercising. I know I should exercise. I want to exercise. And yet, I just don't quite always seem to do it. And I think it's important as we talk about resistance today to realize that everyone, if you're a human being, you experience resistance. It's not that some people have it and some people don't. Everyone has it, but, you know, it just varies by degree in how intensely that we experience it. And ultimately, as academic writers, we all want to write. We got a PhD to do research, to write, to be scholars, and to be scholars, that requires that we produce ideas, that those ideas get from our head onto paper, that they get from paper out into the community of scholars who will debate, discuss, and engage them. I mean, this is what we want, and it's not just what we want, but if you're on the tenure track, it's also what you need to be successful. So we all want to write, but most of us just aren't actually writing, and very few of us are writing every day, 30 to 60 minutes. And when I think about resistance, I sort of just picture in my mind that there's something, you know, on one side is me, on the other side is that thing that I want, and every time I reach towards it, I just get frozen. I just get locked up. It's like something just rises up to stop me from getting that thing that I want. And, you know, I've listed here the common forms of academic resistance. And there's no judgment, there's no shame here. I'm just going to say what they are, and I think you know who you are out there if you've experienced them. I think resistance manifests, particularly for academics, in three primary ways. The first is in terms of procrastination, right? So you know you have to do something, and you just don't do it, you don't do it, you don't do it. Maybe there's a deadline, finally, and when the deadline comes, you sort of stop everything in your life. You go into a writing frenzy, and, you know, you just slide across the finish line. And, of course, the problem is with procrastination that it sets up a really problematic cycle, right? So while we're procrastinating, we feel guilty because we should be doing something. Then when we actually have to do it at the last minute, it creates this frenzy, this anxiety. And then when you're done and you make the deadline, you have to recover because you had to sort of go into this writing frenzy or writing binge to make the deadline, and then, you know, you have to recover from it. And I think what's hard about procrastination is, like, that really worked when we were undergrads because we were, like, I don't know, 19, 20. You could pull all-nighters. You could sort of bounce back in a day or two. But, you know, the older you get and, you know, people depend on you, the less you can really sort of drop everything and go into a one-night or two-night or three-night sort of writing binge and come out the other side. It takes you longer to recover, and really most of us just don't want to live that way. In addition to procrastination, I think the second form of resistance is avoidance. This is my personal favorite. And avoidance, you know, you're just doing anything but writing. And you might actually look like a very productive person because, you know, you're really doing a lot of stuff. But you're just not writing. For me, a lot of times this happens when I sit down to write and the avoidance sets in. And, you know, I just can't possibly write until I fold the laundry or organize my sock drawer or put my hair up or find my fuzzy sweater that I like to write in. You just come up with all these sorts of behaviors that you must do, and they feel very pressing, anything but writing. And finally, and the one I really worry about, although I do worry about procrastination and avoidance, but I think the ones that's the most dangerous is denial, particularly if you're on the tenure track. For a lot of people, they're not writing, and they are in a state of denial. They're in a state of denial that kind of goes like this. Well, you know, I'm working hard. I'm working 60 to 80 hours a week, and, you know, I'm just going to hope that everything's going to turn out okay. And, you know, it doesn't matter how many hours that you're working if none of those hours are being spent on writing. And if you're sort of imagining that your teaching and your service are going to trump a lack of publications when it comes time to evaluate your tenure and promotion, that's often not the case. And so I often work with people after they've had a third-year review, and they were in denial the first couple of years. They kept waiting for the break to come. They would write on the break. Maybe during the summer they would get their writing done. And after 3 years, there was no writing done. They got the third-year review. Your teaching's great. Your service is great. But what we care about here is research. You don't have any, and now you're in a hole, and this is what you're going to need to climb out of it. So I think the result is that when we procrastinate, when we avoid, when we are in denial, it ends up not just in very low productivity, but it's very stressful, and many of us walk around really very hunkered down by guilt when we're engaging in this. So where does resistance come from? Why is it that if we really want something and it's important to us, we just don't do it? And more importantly, how can we overcome it? And I think resistance is incredibly misunderstood when people talk about procrastination and avoidance and denial. I think the problem with not understanding it properly or misunderstanding it is that when we don't understand it, we try to fix it in ways that just aren't going to work, okay? So I think some typical but extraordinarily flawed messages about resistance are things like resistance is fear. Resistance in and of itself is fear. And so if you want to fix it, my advisor always used to say, you know, you just got to do it. You know, if you're stuck in your writing, well, just sit down and write. okay, well, you know, maybe I'll bust out my Nike t-shirt and try to just do it, and that might work for a day or two, but it's not really going to lead to a consistent daily writing habit. I think some people think resistance is low self-esteem, right? So one of my mentors once told me, you know, you just need to raise your self-esteem in order, and then you won't feel any more resistance around writing. So why don't you, you know, before you start writing every day, just look in the mirror and affirm, you know, I'm a brilliant scholar, I'm a brilliant scholar, I'm a brilliant scholar. And, you know, this is problematic for obvious reasons. You know, my looking in the mirror and telling myself I'm a brilliant scholar probably isn't going to raise my self-esteem to begin with. And even, again, if it gets me to write for a couple of days, it's not really going to lead to a consistent writing habit. And finally, I think probably most problematically, people talk about resistance as laziness. It's a lack of motivation. It's a lack of, you know, internal drive or whatever. It's some bad personality trait that you have that needs to be fixed. And if you could just change yourself in this fundamental way, then you would stop having any resistance and you could just write freely. So I think all of these are flawed, not just flawed, but they're just not very helpful. And I think the kinds of ways that people suggest for you to fix these things are unhelpful because they don't really get to the heart of the problem. So if resistance is not fear, if it's not low self-esteem, if it's not just bad personality traits that you need to change, then what is it? And how can we understand it in a way that we can really for real move forward? My favorite author, who's also my writing coach, Barbara Sher, she has a way of describing resistance that I think is really powerful and I think has really fundamentally changed my relationship to my writing and really helped me to move forward towards a consistent daily writing habit. So she says that, you know, resistance is really a defense mechanism. And it's our human response that keeps us from doing anything dangerous. So it's really our response to anything that makes us feel anxiety. So when we sit down to write, for many of us, sitting in front of the computer and saying, I'm going to write my book now, that's something that arouses a tremendous amount of anxiety. And because our anxiety is aroused, our resistance actually rises up to protect us from anything that might harm us, right? So, you know, she's kind of a quite funny person. And she always says, you know, it's important to understand that your resistance is hopelessly stupid. It's just part of being human. And it can't tell whether you are standing at the edge of a cliff about to jump off or you're sitting at your computer declaring that you're going to start writing your book now. They're both the same thing to your resistance, because what happens is you experience anxiety and your resistance rises up to block that feeling of anxiety and to keep you safe from anything that might be dangerous. Now, whenever there's resistance and whenever we feel that sense of we want to do something but we just can't do it, fear is there, it's present, because that's what's arousing our anxiety. But the resistance isn't fear in and of itself. It's how our body sort of develops this defense mechanism to protect us from anything that might be fearful. And I'm saying that because whenever we experience resistance, one of the first things we want to ask ourselves is, what is it that we're afraid of? What are you afraid of? What happens when you literally sit in front of your computer and you put your hands to the keyboard with the true intention of writing that book? And, you know, I've worked with probably just over 2,000 faculty in the past 6 years, and I hear the same kind of fears over and over and over again. They might be a fear of pain. They might be a fear of success or failure. So if I actually write this book or write this article, it may get published, and then people may realize that I'm a fraud and that I'm not as good as they thought I was. Many people have a fear of other people's jealousy and resentment. So if I finish this manuscript, other people may come out, they may attack me, they may try to take me down in some sort of way. So if I just don't finish it, if I just stay under the radar, then I'll be very safe and I won't have to experience other people's negativity. Some people even talk about a fear of happiness. So, you know, some people got the message in their childhood socialization that being happy is selfish, right? I most often hear women talk about this. And that, you know, if they're happy, they might actually make other miserable people in their lives feel uncomfortable. And the one I didn't list on the slides but that I hear often is from people who write about other people's pain or write about social inequalities or social injustice, that any time that you're giving voice to other people's pain and it's connected to your own pain in any way, shape, or form, your resistance is going to erupt, right? It's going to try to protect you from experiencing either the voice of other people's pain or your own pain. And, you know, I'm saying all of these things, and I'm making explicit these fears, because whenever people tell me these things, they tell me in a way that suggests that they're the only person who might be afraid of succeeding, the only person who might be afraid of failing, the only person who might be afraid of speaking the truth to power in some way in their work. And, you know, again, I think it's really important for us to normalize this discussion and to continue to have it. And I think part of what's so important about it is that we tend to think, if I could just get over my personal fears and hang-ups, then I would be free of resistance and I could write freely anytime, anywhere, and I would be productive. And I want to be very clear that I'm saying exactly the opposite of that. What I'm saying is that our resistance, your resistance, my resistance, it's likely to always be with us because it's really part of who we are as human beings. So what I want you to really think about today is just imagining what would happen if we let go of the need to try to conquer our procrastination, to conquer our avoidance, to conquer our denial. And if we let go of the need to try to conquer that, if we let go of the need to try to fundamentally change ourselves, what would happen? What would happen if we just entered a relationship with our resistance? And, you know, Barbara Sher always says, you know, it's great to sort of imagine your resistance as a person, as a literal bodyguard. And if you're looking at the slides, I have a picture of a bodyguard, and apparently he works for AT&T. I'm not exactly sure why. At any rate, if we imagine our bodyguard as a person, right, our resistance as a person, it's helpful because we start to imagine that our resistance is just doing its job by protecting us. And so, you know, Barbara Sher always says, just sit down, shake hands, and get to know this guy, right? Because if you keep in mind that your bodyguard isn't that bright and can't really differentiate between real physical danger and perceived emotional danger, if you keep in mind that, you know, he's kind of a big guy and he genuinely wants to protect you, if you keep in mind that he's really oriented to keeping us from pain and not oriented to logical argumentation, then what ends up happening is that you realize that your goal is not to completely eradicate resistance, but just to get your resistance into a very relaxed state. So anything that you can do to reduce your sense of anxiety is going to keep your resistance relaxed and is going to enable you to move forward. And this is going to be much clearer as we move into talking about different types of writing problems. But I want you to really keep this image of the bodyguard in your mind and really keep in mind that anytime you experience anxiety, and it doesn't have to be about physical danger, it could be your feeling that the production of knowledge is emotionally dangerous, is dangerous in some way to you. Anytime you feel that fear, your bodyguard, it's his job to sort of rise up and protect you. And the way that your bodyguard does that is by creating resistance. And that means procrastination, that means denial, that means avoidance. So the last thing I want to say about really rethinking our resistance is that oftentimes as academics, we just spend so much time beating ourselves up about not writing. You know, I often talk about this as scholarly self-flagellation, but this idea that a lot of our understanding and a lot of our ideas about not writing often involve negative self-talk, and that negative self-talk often involves a lot of negative self-evaluation. And if you don't take anything out of this today, what I want you to take out of it is that is just not helpful. It's not helpful because it's not going to get you writing. And it's not helpful because it discounts the structural reality that your life, finishing the dissertation on the tenure track, is just going to be different than any other time of your professional life in terms of its intensity and in terms of the stakes that are resting on your writing. I also think it's not helpful because it really keeps us focused on personality traits. And this isn't about changing who you are as a person. It's about changing your behavior, okay? Because if I have to wait until I'm perfectly disciplined, self-realized, have self-esteem, and I'm very driven to write, then I'm not going to get any writing done. I have to deal with who I am and where I am, and I have to write anyways, okay? So let's get to the point. Most of you are here because you're in some sort of funk, you've had a funk, you know of someone in a funk, and you want to figure out how to get out of it. So what do you do when you're in a writing funk? Funk just means you're not writing. And I want to suggest that I think there's three types of funk. I'm going to talk mostly about the first and second type, but I want us to keep the third type in mind. The first type of writing funk is what I call technical errors, right? So if you're in a type one funk, you have a vague sense that you should be writing. You know you need to write. You know you need to write to get tenure, to get a job, to have mobility. But you're just not putting any conscious effort into making it a daily priority. So you know you have to do it, but you're just not doing it. And, you know, I think type 1 funk is caused by technical errors because you're just missing some simple skill or simple technique. These are like the tips and tricks to get you writing. And if this is your only problem, that means that your resistance is very minimal. Typically, it's manifesting as avoidance, denial, procrastination. And ultimately, the great news is that if you're in a type 1 funk, it's very easy to fix. So the most common errors that people make are that they haven't set aside a specific time for writing, or they've set aside the wrong time. They have no idea how much time that various tasks take, and they're constantly underestimating the amount of time things take. Another one is that you're just the wrong person for a specific task, and usually this generates because you think you have to do everything. It may be that the tasks you set out are too complex. Sometimes I ask people, can I see your to-do list? And at the top of their to-do list is, make my dissertation into a book. And this is not a to-do item, okay? It's too complex. It's not a task. Maybe it's that you can't remember what you have to do because you're keeping it all in your head. Maybe it's that your space is disorganized, or maybe it's that you just have no idea where your time is going. The great news is this. Again, each of these things are very easy to fix. And generally what this looks like is that, you know, you're going through each week. You feel like you're working very hard because you're working a lot of hours and you're doing a lot. But every week you kind of blink and it's Friday and you've done a lot of stuff, but you haven't done any writing, okay? So I want to just sort of walk briefly through these different errors. And I want to talk about the concrete strategies that you can use to address them. And again, this is the most superficial level of resistance, and these are kind of the more tips and tricks to get you writing. And for many people, once they get writing, they sink into their deeper and true level of resistance, okay? But let's start here. So let's say your error is that you just haven't set aside a specific time for writing. Well, this is very easy to fix. Acquire a calendar if you do not have one. Many people, I'm shocked and amazed, don't have a calendar. Get a calendar. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. It could be a piece of paper. But you need to know what you're doing every week, and you need to schedule your writing time in the same way that you schedule class time and you schedule meeting time. And what that means is it's non-negotiable, okay? It's a professional responsibility. It's in your calendar, and you don't just compromise it because other people want you to do something during that time. I also suggest if you are you don't have a set time for writing that you hold a Sunday meeting. And by a Sunday meeting, all I mean is that you spend 30 minutes at the beginning of the week getting clear about what you need to do that week and putting all the things that you need to do into a specific block of time. What ends up happening for most people is they realize they don't have enough time to do everything, but it's better to know that on Sunday than on Friday, okay? Because on Sunday, you can sort of figure out in a proactive way what to do with the things you don't have time for, and on Friday, they just keep piling up and becoming more stressful. Maybe it's that you haven't, you know, you've set aside the wrong time for writing, and, you know, people often imagine, I think probably the most basic error that people make is that they set their writing time at the end of the day, instead of at the beginning of the day. And, you know, I'm saying here you should determine the best time for you, but the best time for most people is at the beginning of the day, not because they're morning people or not even because they have the most energy, but because it's the most important part of what you do. And so you do it first, and that way you're taking care of your needs and hoping that everyone else's will get met as the day goes on. What often happens is new faculty take care of everybody else's needs, and then they hope that they're going to write at the end of the day. And as I'm saying that, I'm not saying it as a judgment. What I'm saying is that we have to work towards aligning our time with our priorities. So if writing is the primary thing you're going to be evaluated by, it should be the first thing in your schedule. I write in the morning, and I'm definitely not a morning person, and it is very ugly around here every morning. But when I'm done, I'm so happy to be done because the thing that's most important is done for the day. You know, maybe your error is that you have no idea how much time tasks take, and again, that's simple to resolve. What you need to do is keep track of your time and keep track of how long it takes for you to do tasks that you do over and over and over again. Then that way, when you have a repetitive task in your task list, you know exactly how much time to set aside for it. Again, often people grossly underestimate the time that it takes to get something done, and then they feel very disappointed. Maybe it's that you're the wrong person for the task. Again, easy to resolve by just looking at what you need to do and figuring out what needs to be done by you, can't be done by anybody else, and what parts of what you need to get done actually can be done by other people. This often leads to a lot of delegating and a lot of passing things around, and I think that's a very healthy practice for busy people. Maybe your technical error is that your tasks are too complex. Again, this is sort of, I'm going to finish my book is on my to-do list. That's not a task, that's a goal. And so what I suggest that you do if you have a really big task and you feel overwhelmed by it and you keep not doing it because you just don't know where to start is that you just stop, take a piece of paper, and map out all the steps that you need to get that task done. What I often do is I take a piece of paper, and on the right-hand side, I just write down whatever the goal is. On the left-hand side, I make a little stick figure that represents me. And then I try to build a bridge between that goal and me by working backwards. So what are all the things that need to get done to finish my book? Okay? What you want to do is break it down into the smallest possible components. The thing that you could do the next day that's not going to cause you a great deal of anxiety, okay? Maybe your error is that you can't remember what you have to do because you are keeping everything in your head. This is a very common error. Again, it's easy to fix. Just start writing things down. Write them down on a scrap of paper, on a post-it. If you have a paper calendar, write it on the calendar. Whatever you need to do to get all of the things you need to do in one place. What that does is it makes it very easy when you sit down once a week to figure out what you need to do and when you're going to do it because you have everything in one place. Maybe your space is disorganized. You know, again, simple to resolve, organize it. Maybe your error is that you have no idea where your time is going, a very common error. Just spend 1 week. Just track your time in 15-minute increments. Again, it doesn't have to be anything difficult. Just put a post-it note by the side of your desk and just keep track of where your time is actually going. This is a great exercise for you to do. We do this once in a while on my discussion forum, and it leads to amazing insights about how different people's values and priorities are with how they're actually spending their time. So each of these strategies that I've described, and again, these are really the tips and tricks, they're really designed to provide a structure for your writing, but even a structure, any structure, no matter how good it is, it's still going to require support and accountability. And so what I've suggested here is that, you know, you really figure out what you need, what's meaningful to you in terms of support and accountability, and you make that happen, okay? And I encourage you to stay flexible because what you need in terms of support and accountability may be different at different times of the year, at different times of your life. And so it's important to really know what's available and to know what your needs are so that you can go ahead and meet them. So I give you just some examples here just to stimulate your sense of building an accountability. One example is right on site. We have this in Chicago. Basically, we meet once a week every Friday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at a coffee shop, and we write. We don't read each other's writing. We don't talk about each other's writing. We just show up and write, okay? And what it does is it meets the need of just being with other people and not being physically isolated. I can't exactly explain why it works, but it really works. And it's a wonderful, wonderful thing that's easy to set up. There's many online writing groups, so if you're someone who needs daily contact and support, you may want to consider an online writing group. On my website, and I give you the URL at the end of this packet of slides, I have links to a variety of different online writing groups. There are free groups. There are groups you can pay for. There's all kinds of things out there. But what they do is they enable you to check in with someone on a daily basis and go ahead and stay accountable for your daily writing. Some people like weekly accountability groups, and these are just small groups of four people. They meet for exactly 1 hour, and they meet. They make a commitment for a semester. And during that 1 hour, each person gets 15 minutes to say, these were my writing goals last week. Either I met them or I didn't meet them. If I didn't meet them, this is why I didn't meet them. And these are my goals for the next week. And it sounds very simple, but it really meets the need of support and problem solving to keep you really focused on continuing your writing and moving forward throughout an entire semester. I've mentioned before, I have a professional writing coach. There's plenty out there. If you need a lot of accountability, like you need somebody to call you, help you sort of structure your week, keep you accountable for moving forward, I think a writing coach is a great idea. And I think the ultimate in accountability is what's called a professional nag. And this is for people who they're fine in their writing once they get started, but they just need help getting started each day. And so this woman, she calls herself a nag. I'm not just being mean. But what she does is she calls you at the beginning of your writing time. You have to tell her what you're going to do that day, and then you have to report in at the end of your writing time. And, you know, if you don't do it, she's kind of mean. And I don't know. I really like it. It's not for everybody, but what I'm trying to do is sort of give you a sense of the broad range of accountability mechanisms. So in this last 10 minutes that we have together, I want to talk about the second type of writing funk. Because for many people, you try the tips and tricks. They work for a week or so. And then you're right back to where you started, which is not writing. And I think the type two writing funks are, it's not just that you're missing a skill or a technique. It's that you have a real psychological block. It could be occurring for a variety of reasons. You don't really have time to unravel those, but what you need to do is to be able to deal with it. For whatever reason, your writing has aroused some anxiety that's not just rooted in techniques, but it's really rooted in a psychological issue. And the most common psychological blocks are a sense of disempowerment about writing, perfectionism, having unrealistically high expectations, having unclear goals about your life and or a denial of what you really want and desire for your life, and you know, this fear of pain, success, failure, et cetera. And so what I want to do in this last few minutes is to talk briefly. I think what I'll do is I'm going to focus on the biggest psychological block, the most common one. And I'll just focus on one, even though there's a number of them in the slides that you can go through at a later date. But I want to focus on one because really moving through type 2 funk is about a process. And the process is identifying what the psychological block is, reflecting kind of consciously on what that block is. Secondly, it's about releasing the anxiety-producing elements. And then it's about responding in such a way that you're able to work towards lowering your anxiety and thereby lowering the resistance. So let's talk about perfectionism, because there's a lot of perfectionism in the academy. It shouldn't be surprising to any of us that perfectionism can be a really debilitating psychological block. And so what I encourage people to do, if they know that they're a perfectionist, they know that they're experiencing resistance, and their resistance is tied to their perfectionism, that you stop to reflect and really ask yourself, what are my standards? Where are these standards coming from? Who around me is living up to these standards? And importantly, are these particular standards accurate for my current status? So oftentimes I have graduate students who are frozen in their writing, and they're frozen in their writing because they expect to produce a first draft that is as polished and provocative as the books that they're reading in their seminars. And if I believe that I have to produce on a first draft something as polished and provocative as a book I've read for a class, which has been selected for its excellence, that's a problem because it's an unrealistically high standard. No one else around them is living up to that standard, and it's just not only realistic but not accurate to where they are. So once you've identified, okay, I'm locked up because of my perfectionism, I've identified what my standard is, I kind of know it's unrealistically high, I don't see anyone around me living up to it, and it's not really helpful based on where I am, I think what you want to do is really release yourself from this unrealistically high standard. Really release yourself from the need to be perfect. Give yourself permission to write a really crappy first draft with the understanding and the knowledge that things always start out rough, they get better over time, and that yours also will get better over time. And in terms of a concrete response, because that sounds all nice and logical, but in terms of a concrete response, I just want to encourage you to really identify your inner critic. Start to write down the dialogue that your inner critic has. Start to really understand what the negative messages are and how you can consciously engage them. You know, a very just concrete activity is when you're writing, literally have a post-it note next to you, and every time you start hearing this negative self-talk, just write down what it is. Most of the time, as soon as you see it, it will stop. As soon as you make it explicit, it will stop. But you'll also be able to see that it's really not particularly true. And if you're looking at the slides, you know, I put a picture of my inner critic, because sometimes it's helpful to think of your inner critic as a person. Mine is Dolores Umbridge. If you're a Harry Potter fan, you know she's the Hogwarts High Inquisitor. And really, Dolores Umbridge, quite frankly, is some compilation of the meanest nuns I ever had in elementary school and my mother on a really bad day, right? And the reason that I picture her is because if I can picture her, then I can throw her out of my office when I really, really need to. And I realize that we're getting close to our time, so let me just finish up in this last 3 minutes. I think what I want to do is just review this process that I think is really helpful when you have psychological blocks and just talk for 1 minute about type 3 funk. Again, when you realize that it's not just about tips and tricks, but that you're having a significant psychological block, what you need to do is be clear about what it is, to release yourself from the need to fix it in the moment. You just want to become aware of its
presence.
Three
not going up and one getting trying to get over. Gobble, gobble.
Oh, sorry, I can hear somebody. And finally, I just want to say your response is usually most effective if you can respond in a way that sneaks around your resistance, that lowers your anxiety, that lowers your sense of threat around writing so that your bodyguard is at ease. So let me just finish up and talk about this type 3 funk since we're very close to our time. You know, type 3 funk is simply that, you know, you're a human being. You might be, we all experience periods of time when we have personal crisis, when we experience kind of a paralyzing loss from grief or some sort of pain. And I think we just need to acknowledge when we're in that place that we're not going to be real productive. We need to be able to consciously adjust our expectations about what's possible. We need to let people know what's happening and allow them to support us. We need to ask for very specific types of assistance, and we need to allow ourselves the time to heal. And I'm saying all of this because, you know, the point of this workshop is really that if you're able to identify what's holding you back, then you can identify the type of strategy, the type of idea, the type of process that can bring you through the writing block itself. When you're experiencing loss and grief, trying tips and tricks are not going to work. You're not experiencing a psychological block. You're experiencing profound pain, and that requires a sense of healing. So give yourself the space to go ahead and do that. So let me just finish up by saying that if you can, whatever you need to do to establish that daily writing habit, it will accommodate for the ups and downs of life. And so whatever it is that you need to do to get yourself seated in your chair for 30 minutes every day, Monday through Friday, preferably at the beginning of the week, that is really ideal. I'm going to stay on the line for another 20 to 30 minutes. And if you have the slides, you'll notice that I've put my website down there. I imagine that this is sort of a beginning of a relationship. And so what I encourage you to do is visit the website. I have a lot of resources there, a lot of referrals there. And ultimately, there's also a link to join my discussion forum. And I strongly recommend that you do that because we have online writing groups. They're free. It's a good place to get started and to really have a supportive community where you can discuss the type of writing funk that you have and hear the ways that other people have moved through it. So I'm going to stop there. And Amy, I don't know if you want to facilitate the questions or if I should, but I really want to appreciate everyone coming today, and I'll hang out here for another 20 minutes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
What's the academic office was underneath
sure.
Organized?
I have two chapters in my book that are probably very helpful to people. You know, the book is called The Black Academic's Guide to Winning Tenure Without Losing Your Soul. But the core chapters are really where I walk you through the process. The academic office is literally, it's a short chapter about organizing your office. There's a chapter about creating a semester plan, and really it's 15 pages just walking you through the basic steps of how do you take a big goal like writing a book and how do you get it down to this is what I'm going to do this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I can do is I'll put those two chapters up as PDF files when I get off the phone, and people can go ahead and download those for free because I think they're quite helpful to anyone.
They'll be how do we download them?
Well, there's a link that says, if you go to the website, it says resources and referrals or something like this.
On your website?
Mm-hmm. And I will put them right at the top for you.
Okay.
And it'll say academic office.
So newfacultysuccess.com?
Yes.
And then go to resources and referrals?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
I'll put those at the top, and one will say academic office, and the other will say tenure and time management. And you
okay,
can
cool.
just download those as PDF files.
And then the writing coach and professional nag, did you say where you find those and how much they cost and that sort of thing?
It's in the same place, that resources and referrals.
Okay.
I'd give you my the link to the NAG, the link to a variety of writing retreats, writing coaches, productivity coaches. My favorite online writing group is the Academic Ladder. It's excellent, just incredibly excellent. It does cost a fee, but it's as far as the fee-based writing groups online go, it's the very, very best.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much.
Questions, anyone?
You can press 4-star to unmute yourself to ask a question, and when you're done with your question, if you could please press 4-star again to eliminate any background noise.
Hi, yes, I just had a question. You said Barbara Scher is the person who was helping you out. Is that S-H-E-R?
It is, and I'll be very even more specific. As I was transitioning from writing for an academic audience to writing for a broader audience, that's when I needed help. And she runs a wonderful program that helps people write for regular folks and also develop, develop ways of speaking and giving workshops that don't alienate people. And I think her website is like barbershare.com. Other questions?
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you so much for the workshop. I find it really, really helpful. But one of the things that I have to say is as I'm sitting here listening to you go through the different ideas and strategies, I'm feeling anxiety right now.
Okay.
Just around the idea of getting started.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if maybe you can speak to how to get over that sort of getting started hump. Because the information, I think, is really phenomenal and useful. But as I was sitting here taking notes on the presentation, I could feel my heart start to pound and a little bit and try to do this. So if you could just speak to that a little bit.
Sure. Again, a lot of times people say, when I listen to one of your workshops, it's like drinking from a fire hose, right? I appreciate all of the broad array of information and strategies, but I don't know where to start, right? So if what you mean is that you feel anxiety about getting started because there's so many things you don't know what to pick, the easiest way I think to get started is to set 30 minutes starting today through Friday for your writing time. And, I think it's helpful not to do this in isolation. So, you can go to my website if you join the discussion forum. We have a daily writing check-in, right? So there's a section called Publish and Flourish, and there's a group of us that we check in every day at the end of our writing time. And if you say, I'm going to write today for 30 minutes, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, then when you're done, just check in. And, there will be people who will say, go, girl, woohoo, you wrote, yay. And, hopefully that will be enough cheerleading to get you to start the next day, right? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you just go from there, right? Because when you sit down to write for 30 minutes today or tomorrow, you're going to notice that either it's easy or difficult. If it's difficult, then that's when you want to start just observing for yourself, why is this so hard? How do I feel? What am I afraid of? What's going on with me? And once you get clear about pinpointing it, then that's when you can start to apply these other types of suggestions. So start very small.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Hi, may I ask a question?
Hi, who are you?
Melanie, Texas A&M.
Hi, Melanie.
I have a quick question. For the 30 minutes a day of writing, if I'm starting at that place,
yes.
What is actually going on during that time? Because I work with a professor here, and she has, you know, writing studios and things for us.
Yes.
But she kind of defines a difference. So I'd like to know how you define the actual writing that's taking place, or is it revision time sometimes, or like what is the writing that's going on during that time?
Yeah, I'm real flexible and loose in this. I think for most people, if they're writing anything 30 minutes a day, it's more than they're usually doing. So I don't think there needs to be a lot of rigidity around what you're doing. I think what you're doing is just going to reflect what you're working on and where you are in a project, right? So if you're at the very beginning, you might be drafting something. If you're in the middle, that writing time might be revising. If you're at a stuck point, your writing might be doing a mind map to get you out of the stuckness. It might be making a list. It might be going over page proofs. It might be working on a bibliography. I define that writing time as anything that is work towards moving a manuscript out the door. It's not reading time. It's not data analysis time. It's just writing time. But what happens during that writing time, I think, is reflective of where you are in the project. Does that make sense?
I'm sorry, I was on mute. Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay, good.
Hi, can I ask a question?
Hi, who are you?
This is Janice, and I'm at Florida State.
Hi, Janice.
Hi. I am just now a beginning doctoral student,
okay. And
I want to try to get a head start on this writing aspect.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if I should just be writing creatively or should I be doing academic writing. And the other question that I have is, are your resources for creative writing as well? Are they useful for people who do creative writing as well?
Well, let me answer the latter part first. You know, I think the tips and tricks are helpful for anyone. I didn't make any of these up. These are all things that are tried and tested by other people. I think everybody benefits from writing every day, whether you're working on a creative project or whether you're working on academic writing. But I think your first question is quite a bit, in some ways, more interesting, which is, so what is writing when you're at the very beginning of being a doctoral student? So I'm assuming that you are taking classes. You're not sort of working yet independently on a thesis or dissertation. I still think it's good to create the habit, right? So you're still putting that in your calendar every day for 30 to 60 minutes. What you do during that time, to me, I would do whatever writing is associated with your coursework or with your, if you have a research assistantship, what's associated with that. And part of the reason I'm saying this is because, you know, a lot of times I think we think that writing is what you do after you've done your thinking. And for me, my mentor always taught me that writing is thinking. So there's writing to be done at every stage of the research process, whether you're in class and you've read something and you want to do some writing to reflect on it, how it might connect to a project that's brewing in your mind as a potential thesis or a dissertation, whether it's writing a seminar paper for your course. Lots of people wait till the very end. You can be writing on that in that 30 minutes. And actually, I want to suggest another type of writing during that time, and that's writing about your experience as a doctoral student. I didn't talk about it in this session, but, you know, going through the process of getting a PhD and getting tenure is brutal. It's often incredibly difficult. And I think the more people can get in touch with what's going on with them in the process, that will not only help you be more productive, but I think it will help you to get through the process itself in a way that also helps you to maintain your relationships, your integrity, your health, and who you are as a person. So I just, you know, congratulations, Jazz. I'm glad you're starting, and I'm especially glad that you are thinking about writing now. But I think the primary part that's important is that you start to develop the habit and the technique of doing it every day, that you allow yourself the freedom to, for that time, to reflect what you're actually doing, and then that will evolve as your research agenda and your professional career evolve.
Okay. When you say every day, do you mean 7 days a week, five days a week?
No. Great question. No, I absolutely mean 5 days a week.
Okay.
Because I think everyone not only should have a break, but you actually need a break, right? Your productivity goes down when you don't have rest, when you don't have relaxation, when you don't have time. So the good news is that if you're actually writing every day, then you're not going to feel guilty about taking your weekend off. You'll actually be able to enjoy that because you will know that the things that need to get done are getting done.
Thank you. This has been very helpful to me. Thank you.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thanks for coming. Other questions?
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. I was just wondering, I know you've referred us to an array of resources, particularly I've always thought about the writing group or the, you know, checking in, and that those are the technical strategies I haven't been as good at.
Okay.
And I think part of it is that part of my resistance actually is that I don't trust other people. You know, that I, in other words, that like if I choose to say be accountable to a co-author, maybe that's too close to the work, you know, and if I can't be honest about, oh, oops, I didn't get around to that one today because there's another project that I was working on. So do you have any advice about who, what kind of people are good to choose when you're forming a writing group or you're, you know, developing accountability measures?
Yeah, I mean, I think you want to be accountable to people who you know are going to hold you accountable, right? and who are not going to judge you negatively based on what you've done or not done, and they're going to be willing to celebrate your successes, okay? So I would say that a co-author, that's, I agree with your assessment. That would be too close because guess what? If you don't do what you say you're going to do, you're going to feel, you might get judged, right, for not doing it. You have to face something that's more than just accountability. So, you know, my experience is that people find accountability partners in a variety of ways. I think the online writing groups are good because you don't know who the people are, and yet they hold you accountable, right? So you're not going to be judged by them if you do or don't, but you have the freedom to be very honest in an anonymous forum about whether you've done your work or not. And the whole point of checking in is that if you didn't do it, to say why you didn't do it, not because you're, you know, naughty, but because you need to figure out what's keeping you from the writing. And the only way you do it is by working through that in conversation. I think, quite frankly, it's, for me, for whatever reason, I really like to pay somebody to hold me to be accountable. And this is why I use the NAG, because I know because I'm paying her, it's her job, she is going to hold me accountable. There is no two ways about it. I also know if I need to pull the plug, I can pull the plug. But ultimately, it's her job, and that to me is the highest degree of accountability. So if you're forming a group, say on campus, an accountability group, I think you need to pick people who are reliable, who do what they say they're going to do, who you know will hold you accountable. But if that's not going to work for you, you might just want to experiment with an online group and see, does this actually make you feel accountable, or if you don't do the work, you just don't check in.
That's really, really helpful. Thank you.
Oh, I'm glad. Other questions? I hear some breathing, so if you have a question, now's the time.
I do have a question. William, IUPUI.
Hi, William.
What about, I'm sold on this. I write every day. It's really helped my productivity. I track what I write. I'm accountable to someone else.
Yes.
I'm working on a number of projects with others who are not not on board.
Yeah.
So I know in the future I need to choose my collaborators more carefully. How do I sell this to other people?
Well, unfortunately, William, you can't. I think that what ends up happening, because the issue of collaborators is one that comes up over and over again about how to manage collaborations with people who have different work styles. But ultimately, you know, making a fundamental change, and for many people, daily writing is a fundamental change. You have to get to a point that you really fundamentally understand that what you're doing doesn't work. And most people are very slow to get to the point that what they're doing doesn't work and they have to try something else. And regrettably, it often ends up in being that there has to be some kind of crisis point for people to make a change, and that's not something that can be induced externally. Now, you can do a lot of coaxing, you can do a lot of encouraging, you can beg people to just try it for a week. If they're inclined to evidence, you can sort of cite Robert Boyce's study about the difference in pages produced between people who just write when they're inspired and people who write every day. It's an enormous difference. You can do all those things. But probably the best thing you can do is just to be productive yourself, to be an example and a role model for other people, to have a willingness to share information on a regular basis, and just to be present for the moment when people are ready to change. Because when people hit that moment, that's when they'll really take off.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? They're all great questions. Okay, last call for questions. If you have a burning one, this is it. Go ahead and ask.
To unmute yourself, please press 4-star. After you're done asking your question, please press 4-star again to mute yourself so that any background noise would be eliminated. Thank you.
Okay, well, it seems like we are maybe questioned out, so we can go ahead and conclude. And, you know, I just really want to extend a warm invitation to anyone who's been on this call. You can always feel free to contact me by email. You can always join the discussion forum. And ultimately, I just hope that sort of rethinking your resistance and thinking about your writing funk a little bit differently will help you to really move towards some greater productivity. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Carrie Ann, for sharing your expertise with us, and thank you all for participating in today's teleconference. Thank you very much.